Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. I have two guests today who are behind the film Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS. It's a haunting new documentary showing the human stakes of a civil war that has killed 400,000 people and displaced even more. One is Sebastian Younger. He's often been attracted to extremes, as in projects like The Perfect Storm, Tribe, and the Oscar-nominated Restrepo. His filmmaking partner is Nick Quested, also joining us, a prolific producer and director of documentaries. Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS also explores the complicated political picture that has led to few good options in this volatile region. Hell on Earth airs Sunday on National Geographic Channel. I spoke with Nick Quested and Sebastian Younger on Monday and asked them why they wanted to focus on Syria in this film.
Well, Sebastian and I have worked together for many years since Restrepo, and we saw the greatest tragedy of our generation unfolding, and we wanted to explain the full narrative of what happened. People have seen this on the news in a series of little bites, but we wanted to put it in context and explain how a series of protests became a civil war that became a sectarian jihad, and what the ramifications have been for us in Europe after that.
Let's follow that thread. What have some of the ramifications been?
Well, as you can see, there's a pattern of low-cost jihad happening throughout Europe and sometimes in America. And sometimes it's inspired by the Islamic State, and sometimes it's been organized by the Islamic State. I think you're going to see more and more cases where it's just the inspiration rather than actually being organized by them. But the Islamic State is facing military defeat, and the only way for them to be viable is to continue to attack on a different battlefield.
Are you thinking specifically of the attacks we saw in England just recently?
Yeah, the attacks we saw in England are absolutely the case in point.
So a question for both of you. You mentioned Restrepo, obviously a highly acclaimed doc that you worked on together in Afghanistan. What did you learn from that project and the film that followed it about how to do this sort of documentary filmmaking in a war zone?
This is Sebastian here. So my colleague Tim Hetherington and I shot all the footage for Restrepo out at this remote American outpost. We brought it back to Nick, who helped us as an executive producer. I think what I learned out there is that film has an usually I'm an author, I write books, and I realized that film has an incredible capacity to convey an emotional reality to people. If you put them in a cinema and you turn off the lights and they're watching a film, it feels to them like neurologically, it feels to them like they are actually there. And in the case of the film we just made about Syria, one of the things we wanted to do was humanize the plight of refugees, good, decent people who are fleeing great violence with their children. We wanted to humanize them and make people in this country and other countries understand that part of our collective responsibility as citizens of the world is to take care of one another, and that might include allowing war refugees into one's country.
So part of what you do in the film is focus on this family. I think they're a pair of brothers and they have children. And if I have the name right, it's Marwan.
That's right. Marwan and Radwan.
And I have to imagine it was extremely helpful because they filmed a lot of their plight. You're literally in the room with them while the planes are going overhead and they're arguing about plans and where to go. So how did you come across that footage?
Radwan and Marwan are the brothers of Adnan al-Mohammed, who is one of the archaeologists from the National Museum in Damascus. We were working with him to uncover the antiquities trade that the Islamic State used to finance themselves. And he mentioned that his brothers were recently displaced from Aleppo and that they were in Manbij in ISIS-occupied territory and they were looking to come to Turkey. And he said, would that be of any interest to you? And we were obviously fascinated from the beginning. We managed to get them a cell phone that they could use to document themselves. And we wrote them a little two-page how to film yourself. So we said, focus on the children. Tell us how you feel. Try and shoot in close up. Give us geospatial markers so that we know where we are in the world. And they did an incredible job.
I should add, obviously, that working in Syria was became suicidally dangerous. And the normal method of making a film is you take a camera, video camera, and you go and you videotape your subjects. In the case of Syria, we really could not do that. Journalists were being kidnapped and beheaded. And so that required sort of extreme measures, getting cameras into the hands of people, Syrians in Syria, or coordinating our efforts with them so that they could shoot the war on the ground for us and get that footage out to us.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on that. I'm talking to two people who are no stranger to going into dangerous places, but give us a sense of what it was like in Syria in the time covered in the film.
Well, for a journalist, as we said, it was impossible for a Western journalist to go there and operate. So we built a network of journalists and activists. I mean, you can look at many people choosing to fight the war in different ways, and these activists decided to use a camera as their weapon. We lost four journalists, not working with us, but they've subsequently been killed working, doing what they thought was their thing to do to fight the war. So it's a very dangerous occupation, shooting in northern Syria.
Journalism committed by Westerners like myself and Nick would not be possible without the incredibly courageous help of fixers and local journalists on the ground, not just in Syria, but in any war zone. Without those people facilitating on the ground, the work that we do would be virtually impossible. And many good people have died doing this, and they really should be recognized.
We know that ISIS has been a threat to journalists, obviously. We've seen release of the beheading videos and so on. But was there also regime pushback against journalists? I mean, were you dealing with not only having to worry about ISIS, but also Assad?
Well, we applied multiple times for access to the Syrian Arab Republic side of the war, but were rebuffed at every opportunity. We had many conversations with the UN ambassador to Syria, or the Syrian ambassador to the UN, Bashar al-Jafri. And again, he was not willing to go on camera.
No, it was some of those people were very hard to get anything from. Likewise, the Russians. They would have been an important voice in this film. And we just could not get them to talk on camera.
I mean, our offer from the Russians was to go and film the Air Force base in Latakia, which is, you know, we can watch airplanes take off and land all day.
One person who does speak in the film is General Michael Flynn, who has been in the headlines, to say the least, in the time since that interview. What have you made of his fall from grace?
Well, we interviewed Michael Flynn March last year, and we spent a long time discussing with Flynn and his partners before the interview. So we kept the interview in the film because what we felt that we wanted that voice and that facet of what he says in the film, and it made it more poignant that he's in there when he subsequently changes his opinion for his own political gain, which is what he's talking against when in the film. So am I surprised to see his fall from grace? I'm sad to see it because I think Michael Flynn is a very intelligent and well-researched man, but it seemed to, I think it's a part of the function of this administration that he was put in a very difficult position.
I'll direct this question to Sebastian. You wrote recently about President Trump, and you had some very harsh words for him in terms of what you labeled cowardice. Have you seen a policy on Syria articulated by this administration so far?
I mean, I'm a news consumer like you and everyone else, and I have not heard the administration articulate a coherent policy on Syria, no, which is disappointing. On the other hand, I don't think Obama had a particularly coherent policy on Syria either. I think Syria is so complex, so difficult to untangle that a policy might actually be hard to articulate. I think President Trump has unfortunately not even tried to, which is unfortunate.
I have a friend at the State Department who said, if you think you understand what's going on in Syria, you haven't been briefed properly.
Okay, I'm going to put the challenge to you two then to try to lay out for our listeners. Are there good guys there? If Assad goes, does that mean ISIS gets to retake a stronghold to a certain extent? I mean, what outcome should Americans who are concerned about a humanitarian plight be looking for here?
With Russia backing Assad, he's not going to go. And I don't think it's on I doubt that Trump wants to try to force him out. I think the world is more or less united in crushing ISIS, and I think they will be crushed on the battlefield. Crushing an ideology is a different matter. Who knows if that will happen? But a military defeat of ISIS, I think, is entirely possible in the next year on the battlefield. And after that happens, I think hopefully there will be some kind of peace accord that effectively, and this is the good scenario. I mean, this is as optimistic as I dare get. Some kind of peace accord that allows for an effective partition of the country, similar to the one in Bosnia, which also was backed by, could not happen until the Russians, without Russian consent.
I'd also add that even if Assad was to go, the power structure of the country wouldn't change. It's run by a group of approximately six families that basically control all the most important nodes of power and commerce. So it's a deep state that is run by these six families. So even with Assad gone, the life for most ordinary Syrians would be exactly the same.
You mentioned, Sebastian, that you anticipate ISIS being defeated on the battlefield. But one thing the film deals with quite closely is the way the Islamic State has been able to weaponize the internet and to use propaganda to lure adherents, but also to spread ideology. So if ISIS does, you know, is defeated militarily, how much of a concern do you have about what they are able to do online?
Well, I mean, just to start with, ISIS is a tremendously negative thing in Syria. I mean, they've killed an awful lot of Syrians, so obliterating them on the battlefield would be an entirely good thing for the people of Syria. But to your question, worldwide, there are many flavors of radical Islamic ideology that advocate violence against civilians in the West. If battling that does not happen with tanks and guns, obviously, it happens in a different forum. It's interesting. I think it's interesting that those kinds of attacks, the kind of attacks we just saw in the UK and earlier in Europe, they have not really happened in this country. And I think it's because the Muslim population of this country has been incorporated very successfully into American society. It has not been in Europe. And I think there's a real lesson there for how to protect the West against attacks. It basically means you need a successful integration of ostracized Muslim populations into the economic and cultural life of the country.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I am imagining you would say a blanket travel ban from some majority Muslim countries, which the president has kept pushing for on Twitter in recent days, would not be the way to go for the U.S.
I think that sends a really puzzling message to the world. I mean, the countries that he is hoping to ban people from, people from those countries have never conducted terrorist attacks in this country. The attacks in Europe, for the most part, are conducted by people who were born in Europe and are citizens of countries in Europe. So the sense that I get from the travel ban is that it is a political statement to his base in America. It's not really a policy solution to a national problem.
And that problem is indoctrination and ideology.
How many refugees from Syria are still trying to get out or stuck in a third place that's not Europe or the U.S. at this point?
I mean, there's over a million Syrians in southern Turkey alone. I think there's more than that in Jordan. And then throughout Turkey, I think that there's, I don't have the numbers, but a substantial amount. I mean, I think that 5 million people have been displaced by the war at this point. There's been 400,000 people killed. It's one of the greatest movement of people you could imagine. I mean, even in Mosul, you were talking about, you know, or 500,000 people being displaced from Mosul, and how would the KRG government deal with that?
To put it in perspective, I think there's 18 million people in Syria, the equivalent number of casualties for America, if America were involved in a civil war like this, would be around 7 or 8 million American civilian casualties.
Wow. You talked to General Petraeus about the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the toppling of the Ba'ath Party, of which Saddam Hussein was a part. How did that process, which Petraeus calls a mistake, influence the troubles we're seeing today now?
The Ba'ath Party was very prevalent throughout Iraqi society. You needed to be a member of the party to be a teacher or a university lecturer, or let alone work in the military. So the de-Ba'athification of the country led to the disenfranchisement and the exile of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that instantaneously had an animus towards the American occupation. Coupled with that, you have the U.S. backing of a Shia government of by Chalabi. And you start to provoke a insurgency against that Shia influence. There were tit for tat assassinations, and it starts to scale from there. The Al Qaeda in Iraq was a response to the overwhelming Shia dominance of Sunni society.
So what is the lesson there about how to deal with strongmen in that part of the world?
Well, that's a real moral conundrum. Strongmen are invariably grotesquely repressive regimes that crush human rights, but they do keep civil wars from happening. And we saw in the Arab Spring that you can advocate for the advancement of human rights, of democratic rights in Arabic countries, and often it devolves into civil war, and you have an awful lot of civilian casualties. I don't really know what the solution to that is. I do know that that one of the sources of radical Islamic ideology and civil wars in that part of the world is endemic corruption in these repressive states. That seems to be a common denominator in Somalia, Afghanistan under the Taliban. In Syria, in Yemen, all of these in Egypt, in Tunisia. I mean, corruption is the issue that makes people take to the streets. And if the United States really wants to combat terrorism in a very deep way, one of the things we should be combating is deep corruption in other countries in the world.
I think I have time for just one more question, so I want to ask you both a quick technique question. There's unspeakable violence that takes place in this movie, but oftentimes, especially when you're dealing with the propaganda videos, you decide to cut before the worst is shown, and then cut back later once the, you know, whether it's a beheading or a point blank shooting. Watching that, I imagine that there's an argument to be made for showing the raw footage just as a way of awakening Western viewers, but I'm wondering why you decided to do it the way you did.
Well, I mean, there's a thin line between awakening people and traumatizing them and having them mm-hmm. emotionally shut down. There are legal issues with broadcasts, but more important to me, there are moral issues with showing someone in the enormously private moment of their own death. You don't need to do that in order to communicate the horror of that death, and I think it's a much more moral choice to take the viewer up to that moment and then go have the screen go black.
I'd also point out that some of the most effective filmmakers never actually show the impact of a knife on the body. So if you look at the Alfred Hitchcock Psycho, you see the blade, you see the flash of the blade, but you never see the blade cut Anthony. You never see the blade actually hit anyone, and people are still horrified by that sequence to this day. So it's really what you walk away with rather than what you actually see.
We've been speaking with Nick Quested and Sebastian Younger about their film Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS, which airs Sunday on National Geographic Channel. Nick, Sebastian, I just want to thank you so much for your work, your past films, and for this film. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to The Roundtable, on WAMC.